Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. This week shows a collection of four additional interviews from the Future in Review conference we attended 2 weeks ago.
Good morning, John. Yes, we'll speak with CEOs of four very different companies. One that manufactures silicon carbide fiber for 3D printing and ceramic technologies. One that builds systems to better connect schools with families to improve student outcomes and school success. Another company that builds network modeling systems and a risk scoring platform that allows enterprise networks to be resilient to cyber effects. Our final CEO's company designs and builds delivery systems for a wide range of first responder IV applications.
These four guests, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. This morning's first guest from the Future in Review Conference, Trevor Rudderham. He's president and CEO of Haydale Technologies, and this company is the U.S. subsidiary of UK-based Haydale Graphene Industries, which we have been reporting on Cool Science Radio the last 2 years. This new company oversees Haydale's Advanced Materials Strategic Business Unit that encompasses Haydale's ceramic technologies, specializing in silicon carbide fiber and microfiber. Trevor Rudderham, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, so tell me about this change. It happened just about a year ago.
Haydale was looking to expand and has made quite a big expansion globally in the graphene space. They were looking for a platform on which to push forward their graphene portfolio in the US, but were looking for an existing company which was synergistic with the graphene products to build on here. After a long search, we found a company called ACM, which has now been integrated into Haydale. Their primary business was silicon carbide fibers and microfibers. So our US operation is, as I said, the platform for graphene for Haydale in the US, but is also in the silicon carbide fiber and microfiber business.
And can those products be used in 3D printing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Silicon carbide, if I may, and please feel free to stop me if I go off too far into the weeds here, but silicon carbide is nothing new. Silicon carbide, also known as carborundum, is used in jewelry polishing and abrasive materials. Silicon carbide particulate, which is carborundum, is a commodity. It's very cheap. At the other end of the spectrum, a company primarily in Japan makes continuous silicon carbide fiber. That is immensely expensive. It is woven into materials used in military and aerospace, primarily satellite and rocket applications. We fill in the middle ground. We make silicon carbide fibers and microfibers. A human hair is about 70 microns in diameter. A silicon carbide microfiber is 1/100th the diameter of a human hair. And our aspect ratio is 10 to 1. So the length of a silicon carbide microfiber is 10 times its diameter.
At where the Japanese are weaving in silicon carbide with other materials, can you take other materials and put them in a three-day printer and essentially get the same sort of utility?
So what we do is we put silicon carbide fiber and microfiber into a number of other things, into ceramics, into metals, and enhances the properties. It makes it stronger, makes them more durable. In some applications, they can be used for electromagnetic radiation absorption. It can change the thermal properties of the material. It can change the electrical conductivity of the material. So there's a lot of different applications for it. So basically, yes, you add it into another material that enhances its properties. To be candid with you, one of the challenges with silicon carbide, particularly microfiber, is it's expensive. So you want to use it very sparingly. Typically, if you look at something like aluminum, you often used in castings for, you know, all kinds of different applications. You could put silicon carbide microfiber into aluminum and cast it. The part would be immensely expensive.
Right.
Because the silicon carbide microfiber would be homogeneously distributed through the whole part. The really, really exciting thing is that with 3D printing, you can selectively apply silicon carbide fibers and microfibers in the area of the 3D printed part where it's absolutely going to do the most value. It's going to give you the most function for the lowest cost, for the lowest weight, for the lowest volume.
Is that capability new, or has that been around for a while, to be able to selectively send the product that you want to the specific area?
It's new. Who knows what's been happening behind closed doors in some of the really way out, you know, NASA and places. But no, I think with the expansion of additive manufacturing and a lot of people getting into that field, it's accelerating in capability and technology very, very fast.
Is Haydale parent company, or are you two operating as separate divisions?
Haydale in the UK 100% owns Haydale Technology Incorporated here in the US.
Okay, and talk about the synergies between the two companies.
At the moment, the primary one is in the sales development area. So we can obviously use Haydale's capabilities in the UK to push the silicon carbide product made here in the US. And likewise, we are using our sales force and our contacts in the various industries to push the graphene products, which Haydale are at present better known for.
Sure. How do you get your products to market?
It's mainly through high technology shows. We often get found on the web, interestingly enough. A lot of our largest customers have found us by searching for high-tech materials and searching for silicon carbide. I think probably looking for continuous fiber and then finding us as an alternative, which is more practical and lower cost.
What's more expensive by weight, graphene or silicon carbide?
I'm not trying to be evasive here. I can't answer that because there are so many different types of graphene that are being used. And depending on how they're made, how they're functionalized, which is one of Haydale's expertise and core competencies, can hugely affect the cost. But ultimately, what's important is not the individual cost per gram or per kilogram of the material. It's the amount you have to use to transform the properties of the host material. So people can look at our material and say, well, that's crazy expensive. You say, yes, but if you only need to add 0.5% of it by mass into aluminum or titanium or something like that.
And here's the utility. Here's what you get from it.
And here's what you get. And then suddenly say, oh, well, you know, on a weighted average basis, you've hardly moved my cost at all. And we go, that's the secret.
Mm. What are some of the biggest challenges you have in front of you?
Well, as with all these things, getting exposure, getting accepted, a lot of the technologies, a lot of the places which we're trying to use the product have long lead times. You know, aerospace in particular, you know, you think of an aircraft, 10, 12, 15 years of development time. So in those particular fields, it's just time to market. I think in the whole area of nanomaterials and advanced materials, we're at an inflection point. If I could coin a phrase, if I may, we talk about functional intensity. People are very familiar, or a lot of people are familiar with the term value as defined as function over cost, the value equation. What we're talking about now is functional intensity, meaning function per unit mass or function per unit of volume. And in this world where resources are becoming scarce, space is becoming scarce, energy is becoming scarce, and is challenged by global climate change, we're looking to get more from less.
Sure.
To increase the functional intensity of the materials and the products they go into. And that's what nanomaterials, that's what graphene does, that's what silicon carbide fibers and microfibers do. They improve the function or increase the functional intensity of parts. And that's critical going forward to getting more from less for our world.
What do you believe is one of the larger applications for the product?
I can't name names of customers, obviously, for confidentiality reasons, but one of the big opportunities we're pursuing right now is in wear resistance and improving corrosion resistance in areas like coal seam gas, fracking, basically.
Sure.
I know that's not a very fashionable thing to talk about right now, but it is an expanding business. So providing the capability to protect piping in those environments is very, very important. I think we're going to see an increasing amount with the additive manufacturing world where we are putting it into aluminums for, as I said, for aerospace applications, but even things like automotive. When I talk about functional intensity, one of the examples I give is 10 years ago, who would have thought we'd have had aluminum pickup trucks? Now we have aluminum pickup trucks.
We do.
But a lot of the suspension componentry is still steel. We can provide that same strength and durability function with enhanced 3D printed parts, which are going to ensure that we get yet still lighter weight pickup trucks consuming less fuel. So I think automotive, aerospace are particular areas where nanomaterials are going to be really important.
Okay. The facility in the UK, they'll be selling these products as well. You'll be cross-selling each other's products.
We've already had a lot of interest, and the ability to get exposure to the silicon carbide products we make here in the US, in the UK, and the European market in general. Something that the previous owners of the company had looked at, but just didn't have the human resource to go and chase. Now we have an in-place capability in Europe to go and market and support our products.
Well, it all makes sense, and we've been following Haydale now for a couple of years, and it's great to have you all back. Trevor Rotterham, who is the CEO and the president of Haydale on the silicon carbide side here in the U.S., thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
John, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break for underwriters, and when we return, we'll speak with Anu Vaid, who's the founder and president of Parent Square. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m., reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Well, we were just speaking, or rather, John was just speaking with Trevor Rotterham, president and CEO of Haydale Technologies. These interviews were recorded at the Future in Review conference at Stein Erickson Lodge. John, you were lucky enough to be there. I was not. So this morning is made up of interviews that you conducted with some of these guests. Our next guest is Anu Vaid. She is the founder and president of Parent Square. Parent Square is a Santa Barbara startup passionate about better connecting schools with families to improve student outcomes and school success. Here's that interview with John and Anu Vaid.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm now sitting down with Anu Vaid, who is the president and the founder of a company called Parent Square, headquartered in Santa Barbara, California. Anu, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, John. Very excited to be here at the FIRE conference and talking to you.
Yeah, well, we had an opportunity to talk a little while ago in that get-together that we all had. Why don't you take a minute and describe your company and the problems and the solutions that your company addresses.
Yeah, so at Parent Square, we believe that strong school-home partnerships are very important for student success. And in today's age, technology can help build those partnerships and the trust between school and home, regardless of language, culture, or socioeconomic barriers. So Parent Square is a product that helps build those partnerships at school. So really, you know, if you look at today, so one of the most important questions that everybody all over the country is asking is, how are my students doing and what can I do to help them succeed? You know, parents ask this, teachers ask this, principals ask this, I mean, you ask this, everybody does. But it's a very, very hard question to answer, you know, especially in today's age, the changes in technology, all the artificial intelligence and automation are changing the workplace as we know it today.
Yes.
So we're living in times of revolution, literally. You know, there are experts that predicted that 47% of today's job will be done by machines in a couple of decades. So given this changing landscape, it's very important that we teach our kids how to learn. So really learning how to learn is one of the most important skills to teach. And then schools need to recognize that learning is not just at school. It's not something that kids will only do at school. It needs to be something that's inside and outside the school. And so for that, they need to enlist the help of parents and recognize them as the teachers they are in their child's life.
And what unique tools do you have to help this process along?
So what ParentSquare does, so think of ParentSquare as an interactive online system for schools. And just like social media platforms, it is incredibly easy to share information and to share photos and videos. So teachers can do that, providing glimpse into a child's life at school. And really, when they do that, it helps the parents have those conversations with the kids and reinforce what's going on and letting them know how to actually help their child at home. So you build these regular two-way conversations between school and home, or even just giving the opportunity to parents to participate in those conversations is big. So anything that teachers send home can be understood by the parents, and they can ask questions if something is not clear, goes a long way. And with ParentSquare, you know, it's purpose-built for schools, so any busy work that teachers need to do, like managing teacher conference sign-ups or running a poll at school or RSVPs for events, you know, that's all those businesses are taken care of within ParentSquare.
And that's taken care of by the parent or just by the product?
It's by the product. So teachers can easily put up a sign-up list for conferences or for gathering volunteers or donations or anything like that. So,
well, parents want to do everything they can to help their kids, but at the same time, they might be a little anxious about playing this new role. So how do you help to train the parents so that they can do a pretty good job?
So, you know, so as a parent, there are different kinds of parents, really. Those parents that are already involved and want to stay involved, but then there are parents who are really busy and they want to be involved, but they cannot find the time to be involved. So it's bringing all those parents into the fold. So you send them information about how their child is doing at school, how they can help with homework. You know, when teachers send those regular messages, there's the level of transparency and the trust that is built between schools and homes. And that really goes a long way to show the child that school is important to my parents and my parents care, and building those partnerships.
The only way a parent, I believe, the only way a parent would be able to be a part of this is if the school system were to adopt this program, ParentSquare. How long does it take to convince a school system that this is an approach worthy of taking?
So, you know, with ParentSquare, ParentSquare is like a turnkey platform. So we integrate with existing systems within a school. So if they have a student information system where they house all their data, we integrate directly with them. And within ParentSquare, you do not have to wait for the teachers or the parents to join in. So it's because we're integrating with those systems, that information is already there. So we adopt, and schools can start using it within half an hour, literally. And the principals and administrators or teachers, when they send out their first message, it reaches everybody. And if it does not reach some people, we provide amazingly good reports that are helpful for schools to see which families they're not reaching and how they can best reach the families they're not reaching. So,
and how do you measure the success of ParentSquare looking at the school system before ParentSquare was installed?
So, you know, as ParentSquare unfolds, you know, there are conversations happening in ParentSquare and on various different fronts. So we are trying to build an engagement scorecard for schools where we see how they're trying to engage parents and just look for patterns within that, and then how parents are responding to each kind of information. For example, when we get into a school, we automatically build groups based on student criteria, like, is this an English language learner family, or is this a free and reduced lunch student? And we build those groups, and then we track points within those groups. How is this group best being engaged by our school? Are they responding better? Are they coming visiting our website? Are they responding better to the emails, or are they responding to text messages or app notifications? Are they signing up to bring items? Are they RSVPing to some events that we put out a parent night? Was that a better time for them, mm-hmm. or some polls? So we measure on many scales.
And can you quantify your success?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to put up a parent engagement scorecard for schools.
But is it showing success? Is what I'm asking? Is Parent Square delivering what you envisioned it to deliver?
Yeah, right now for our schools, they are very happy with us. And for us, really we measure our success by the success of the schools that are using the product. So anytime that they use the product they are successful is when we are successful. So.
And you're installed in Santa Barbara. Where else are you installed?
So, Santa Barbara is our home base. We started with a couple of schools in Santa Barbara, and our first big win was the district. And the district is a medium-sized district, about 15,000 students in the district. And right now, we're actually signing a deal with one of the country's largest school districts. So that's very exciting for us. So, going from schools to smaller districts to bigger districts, it's been a journey.
Yeah, exactly. Are you installed anywhere in the state of Utah?
So we are in a few schools here and there in Utah. We would love to be in Park City. In fact, Park City, we see a lot of interest from schools here. We just have to take the conversation to the next level. So it's just talking to the right people in the school industry. As you and I know, an educator is very busy, especially administrators, and they have a lot on their mind. And parent involvement is not necessarily on the top of their mind. But if we have those conversations and show how easy it is to get on board and to start using this, perhaps they'll be more interested in bringing this on board.
So Park City, for an example, maybe start with a pilot in their elementary schools and see how that goes and take a good look at that. And then,
Yeah, we do a pilot with a lot of our districts, whenever they see success. And the good thing with Parent Square is we have about a 98% retention rate. So schools come back year after year. So, that's very promising for us.
Yes. And how long has your company been in business?
So, when I first started, it was about 6 years ago, but really about, we were new to the education industry. So really, I would say about 3 years ago is when we went nationwide and we launched Parent Square.
And that was Anu Vaid, founder and president of Parent Square, speaking with my co-host, John Wells, at the Future in Review Conference. We're going to take a short break for our underwriters. When we return, we will speak with Ray Rothrock, the CEO of a company called Red Seal. Stay with us.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Anu Vaid, founder and president of Parent Square. Our next guest from the Future in Review Conference, Ray Rothrock, CEO of Red Seal. Red Seal's network model and risk scoring platform is the foundation for enabling enterprise networks to be resilient to cyber events. Red Seal helps customers understand their network from the inside out, providing actionable intelligence, situational awareness, and a digital resilience score to help enterprises measure and improve their resilience. Ray Rothrock, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much, John.
You have a fascinating company, so why don't you take a minute and just describe what you do?
Sure, thank you. Our company is focused on what I think is sort of the third era of cybersecurity. The first era was prevention, firewalls. The second era was about detection, and then you could maybe do something about it. But we're in this new era now where prevention and detection are only sort of jacks or better. They're necessary, but they're not sufficient to really protect the enterprise. So we have some technology that models the network and scores the network's cyber readiness. Being ready for an attack is just what you've got to do today. These attacks that we've read about in the news, they have the best engineers, the best firewalls, the best detection software, but they're getting killed. Just take Equifax. Half their market cap has already been wiped out in the last 2 months. I mean, these are staggering risk to companies.
And one of the main problems was they did not keep up with their patches on that one line of servers.
That's exactly right. So in our scoring, we analyze the equipment, and if house is up to date, we analyze all the pathways that happen and if they are in policy. Every company has a policy, so we can evaluate whether or not you've built your network like you want it. If you have cloud operations or hybrid operations, we can evaluate all that as well. A lot of people are moving to the cloud these days for economic reasons. So you got to have a complete picture. And we call it resilience, digital resilience, the ability to withstand an attack. So you discover a problem, you're getting hit hard. What actions do you want to take? Our software tells you what actions to take.
So not only will your software be able to ascertain what vulnerabilities exist, but also you can look at areas where maybe they're spending too much money, where they really don't have to, and they really need to shore up this other side.
That's exactly right. Once we build our model, we import vulnerability scans from other vendors, companies like Rapid7, Tenable, and Qualys. We bring that in, and we integrate that data with our model, and that allows us to prioritize, to the point you just made, what is most vulnerable in the network so that you don't waste all your time, energy, and money, which you have very precious time, energy, and money these days, on things that don't matter. And it's that prioritization that really matters. I mean, you take a normal corporation, $1 billion company, they probably have a network that has, 100,000 endpoints, maybe 10,000 vulnerabilities. Where do you start? Hand the engineer a service package, go fix this. Where do you start? WannaCry, this very famous one of the infamous attack. We had a vendor that had 5 million endpoints. They used our software. They found 30,000 WannaCry vulnerabilities in their network. We narrowed it down to 110 vulnerability issues that they had to worry about in their company. And so we told them exactly which ones to go get.
Julie Parrish made a great point when we were meeting earlier. She's your chief marketing officer, about the importance, even on a smart device such as an iPhone or an Android, of keeping up with the patches and the software updates. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There are two basic rules in cyber hygiene, we call it. One is change your password. The other is keeping your equipment as ready as ever by getting the latest patch. If you read all the details about patching, security is always in there. There's always a vulnerability. And when it's found, a patch is created and you should update it, whether it's your cell phone, your router, your computer, whatever. You should stay at the most ready example, the most readiness that you can possibly stay.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't understand that, maybe in their household they have, let's say, a couple of Apple laptops and maybe an iPad and some iPhones maybe, and that's kind of their network. These corporate networks are, as you said, thousands and thousands of endpoints. They're heterogeneous. There's every vendor you can possibly imagine. There are more possibilities for problems. These are complex networks.
They're very complex networks, and not all that equipment talks to each other easily. One of our value adds that we bring is we understand all those 160 different devices. We have to in order to build that model. Mm-hmm. And giving the customer the complete picture of their network, regardless of who they picked, Cisco, Juniper, Huawei, it doesn't matter who you pick to build your network. We understand it all and give it to you in a nice, simple package with this score that says you're good here, or you're not good there, and this is the things you can do to make your score better.
And do you sell subscription services so that you can come back, let's say, in 6 months or 9 months or in 12 months and be able to reevaluate again?
We do. We call it a health check, mm-hmm. and we recommend it highly. We help our customers get the model up and running, and then we come back on a regular basis if they're not doing it to make sure it's in good shape.
Yeah. Tell me about your product relative to the competition.
Well, there's a lot of competition in this general category, but there's nothing specifically that models it quite at the robustness that we do. There are people who model. A competitor, some people might think a firewall management company. These are people, you know, every big corporate has maybe 1,000 firewalls or 5,000, and they have policies that they want to update those firewalls simultaneously. We don't do that. We evaluate whether or not they did it right. We also evaluate, so firewall A on one side of the organization, firewall B at another campus in another city, are those in conflict with each other? Have you violated a policy when you make those changes? That's what our software does. Another competitor might be vulnerability management. So people think they can just scan their networks. Well, our software finds those the parts of the network that could not be scanned for a firewall error or a router error. So it's really what we provide is a platform that understands the firewalls, understands the routers, understands the scanners, understands the patch level of your network so that we can calculate all that to you. So we're part of an ecosystem, if you will, and we try to bring all those partners together.
So let me ask you about this challenge. Let's say that there's a corporation and they have a number of different networks, but they also have suppliers and they're connected to those networks. And maybe those suppliers are connected to some other third-party networks. It's the weakest link that's going to take the whole thing down. How do you make sure the whole thing comes together?
I'm glad you brought that up because it is the weakest link, and we have some of our more sophisticated clients actually run RedSeal on their suppliers' networks, and if your score isn't to a certain level, you cannot attach for communications. The other thing that's a very good use here is M&A. Let's say your network, you're a big company, and your network is a 650, and that's cool. And before you acquire another company, you go and run our software, and it's a 450. Well, what's going to happen when you merge those two networks? Your score is going down. It's
That's
not
right.
going up.
That's right.
So, or you could use that score for better negotiation or put it in, you know, there's lots of ways to use it. But M&A and legal services is a big area. Also, just finding, if you can isolate the network and where am I going with this? Sorry. The investigation that you can do on the part of the network that's at risk or is under attack is very deep, and people use it for that as well.
You have a degree in nuclear engineering from Texas A&M. You're right. A long way from home there, aren't you?
I sure am, yeah. Are you asking why am I sitting in this seat now?
No, I think it's fascinating because I love to talk to people about where they originally came from and some of the changes that they've made. And cybersecurity, of course, is a very important problem in this country right now, well, across the world.
Yeah.
But nuclear engineering, that's an interesting discipline.
It is. And in fact, I'm a trained nuclear engineer, and I worked in a power plant for many years. But the same concept is called defense in depth. Those concepts and those philosophies also apply to your cyber network. People architect their networks. They're built from scratch. So how do you think about it? How can I defend? Where are my important assets? What backup systems do I need to protect that part of the network? That philosophy operates in a network, at a power plant, in an airplane. So that's the kind of thinking I think that requires. You got to be able to anticipate what can go wrong. In a nuclear power plant, we anticipate that pipes can break or pumps won't work, and so we have backup systems. In a network, you got to anticipate. If this router is compromised, what happens? Just ask Sony about those compromised routers. It's a very big deal.
Sure is.
You don't know unless you model it, test it, and then take remedial action against it.
How can people get in touch with your company?
We are located in Sunnyvale, California, in the heart of the Silicon Valley. We are redseal.net on the web, and we can, send me an email. I'm Ray at redseal.net, and you can send me an email, and I will make sure we get in touch with you.
Ray Rothrock. Rothrock. It's a tongue twister. Ray Rothrock, who is the founder and CEO of RedSeal. Thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you have a great conference.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. And we are back here on Cool Science Radio. Lynn, I remember a couple of years ago when the BlackRock conference in Las Vegas was meeting. That's the big cybersecurity conference it wasn't BlackRock. It was Black something.
I forget.
Yeah. Anyway, so they were meeting and they came up with this thing where these guys presented that if you had an Apple iPhone and you used a foreign charger, like, you know, you go to malls and they have these chargers there that you can connect to for free, or airports where you can connect for free, that they were able to download malware from the chargers into the iPhone.
Right.
And there are all sorts of different ways to infect devices. And then something interesting happened at the Future in Review conference where one of the presenters was talking about cybersecurity and mentioned that somebody took a piece of DNA for sequencing and put it into the equipment for the sequencing, and they embed it in the DNA of a computer virus to infect the computer that was looking at the DNA. It, in fact, opened the computer virus and infected the computer that was analyzing the DNA for sequencing, if you can follow that. But it was just amazing all the different ways that you can, you know, wreak havoc on a computer or a computer network. Anyway, we're going to take a short break for our underwriters. When we return, we're going to speak with Brett Moore, CEO of Mobile IV Systems. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. We were just speaking with Ray Rothrock, the CEO of Red Seal. Our next and final guest that John interviewed during the Future in Review or the FIRE conference at Stein Erickson Lodge took place a couple weeks ago is Brett Moore. He's the CEO of Mobile IV Systems. Mobile IV designs and builds IV delivery systems for a wide range of first responder IV applications. When we say IV, we mean intravenous. We're switching gears a bit from cybersecurity over into the healthcare industry. Brett Moore, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm now sitting down with Brett Moore, who is the CEO of Mobile IV Systems, LLC, located in New York. Brett, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So is this your first Future in Review?
It is. It's been fabulous so far. It's geek heaven.
It really is. And you've got a geeky product. You've got a really cool product. Why don't you tell us about it?
We do. I'm the CEO of Mobile IV Systems, and what we have is a mobile, ruggedized, automated pressure infuser for standard IV fluids and blood. And basically what that means is instead of holding up a saline or a blood bag to infuse fluids into a wounded person, we have something that pressurizes the bag automatically and safely infuses the fluid into the wounded person.
So in a disaster type situation where they're trying to triage and they're trying to make decisions as quickly as they can, a medic can go up and set this up without having to worry about elevating the bag and then maybe move on to the next person and come back and check on that person a little bit later.
Exactly. It's set and forget. It's actually unique. It's one of a kind. And because people can't see it, let me describe it to people so they can visualize it. What you have is a cuff that's maybe a little over a foot long. And inside that cuff, you just push whatever blood or standard IV fluids you have. The bag has a tube set, an administration line, which goes down into the patient. And the two most special components of it, other than the cuff itself, are a regulator that looks like a really big cigar sitting on the outside, and what's called an all-position drip cup. What the regulator does is we put a CO2 cartridge in there. That's our power source. And when you slightly twist the end of the cartridge, 850 psi of pressure goes through two chambers with pistons and valves and inflates the cuff around the IV bag, thereby pushing the fluid down the line. It goes through our all-position drip cup, which takes the air out of the system, also first of its kind. So what you can do is put fluids into the person safely and consistently, and once you've done that, you can put the bag on the ground between the injured person's legs on a stretcher. You can put it inside their jacket.
And the applications for this are really huge. And we were talking before we rolled tape. One, it streamlines the entire triage program process. Two, one person versus two, and that one person could then go on and work on the next person. And three, it's just a mobile safety whole way of being able to get whole blood into someone.
Exactly. In fact, what you'll find with this is that it's typically used in forward combat, or it can be used for people like FEMA. If you think about Haiti a number of years ago, they had 200,000 casualties. Sadly, we've recently had the hurricanes. So for uses, whether it's FEMA stockpiling them for those sort of opportunities, or if you're in a SEAL team, we have an ex-SEAL team guy who works with us, you need to be able to get fluids into people quickly and safely. So it has multiple applications.
Well, in a firefight, you certainly can't raise a bag and identify where the wounded person is. So this is a way of being able to get to someone in the field who's in a firefight and be able to administer fluids to them immediately.
That's right. In fact, one of the problems you have for guys on small teams is you've already got a medic who's tending to someone who's wounded. The last thing you need is to take another person out of the firefight who then has to hold the bag up. And what you'll often see in combat pictures is someone actually holding the bag in their teeth. Multiple pictures of soldiers holding a rifle and holding the bag in their teeth to provide some kind of gravity pressure. At worst, you might roll the person over on the saline bag. So we've had a lot of very imperfect approaches. But you're right, it streamlines triage. The phrase the military likes is force multiplier. If we halve the workload, make this set and forget, give the medic time to do other things, and enable them to treat more people, save more people, it's a force multiplier.
Exactly. So you are privately held. You are in New York City?
I'm in Brooklyn. I'm okay. An Aussie, but I'm a proud Brooklyn dweller. We do have a lot of partners up to New Hampshire and down to Maryland, so that whole medical technology corridor is really important to us. But the product has a great backstory. It started under an Army feasibility study 10 to 12 years ago, where the Army realized that they needed to get away from really bulky equipment forward. And this started in Alaska. So you have a group of Alaskan commercial fishermen who became the first funders, and they are today still our majority shareholders. We're a private company, hoping to obviously grow and find new financial partners. But we have some amazingly solid people behind us who've supported us all the way.
That's a great story. And you are shipping product.
We are hope to soon ship product. Where we actually are at the moment is we are just pre-manufacturing and pre-revenue. So what we're doing is we're just about to enter into some collaborations with people like the Army Medical Research and Material Corps, hopefully the Blood Bank and others. This product was originally designed for saline. So about $5.1 million in over 10 years was put in to develop saline. Interestingly, what 11 years of war have shown us is that the real application is blood. The military has now worked out that putting saline in upfront is not the ideal way to do things. We need the application of fresh whole blood. What that does, particularly for serious hemorrhagic injuries, is it statistically increases survivability. It gets you to hospital alive and or in better shape. So the application of blood is key. And we're now confirming with people that this device works just as well with blood as it does with saline. On the saline side, or standard IV fluids, it could be used tomorrow for air transportation and even rescue. If you think of mountain rescue, people lose a lot of fluid, maybe not blood, but they've lost a lot of fluid. So mountain rescue, general rescue situations, and air transport where you don't want a lot of cords and things rattling around.
No, that's right. And the rationale for whole blood over saline, does that translate well to FEMA type response?
Yes,
victims?
It does. And to use a sad but very recent example, with the Las Vegas massacre, I think we lost 58 people and a few hundred wounded.
Right.
The SEAL medic on our team, Mark Donald, who in fact one of the most
Decorated,
sadly wounded also, but most decorated soldiers with a Navy Cross and Silver Star. He commented to me the other day that we probably could have saved half the people in the Vegas massacre had we been able to turn up with blood and with this delivery infusion unit, because when you have those sort of injuries, people bleed out.
Right.
And I don't want to be insensitive to the families, and my prayers go out to them, but putting this kind of unit up front really helps because
this would have added value.
Yeah, medical evacuation is slow. You can often do 2.5 people in 45 minutes. You've got to get them to a trauma center. Las Vegas had a level one, top level trauma center. They were close with a lot of ambulances. In many cases, you don't have any of those advantages. So if you have this unit and blood, then you could be saving a lot of lives.
Yeah. And of course, it's also possible that some of these people bled out without any medical attention because these bullets are so invasive and destructive that that it doesn't take very long.
No, and it's tragic. And so what we hope to do is to be part of the solution,
right?
Not just with medical teams and not just with Spec Ops people, who will be some of our major customers, but also dealing with FEMA, Red Cross, and when you think of 200,000 people who were injured in Haiti way back when, and people being treated on the footpath, if we can get units like these out efficiently to people again with blood, then many, many lives can be saved. And whole project started for me, well, in fact, as a project. I was brought in 2 years ago as a CEO. But honestly, John, it's become a passion. And the passion is that we save lives.
Yeah. I think you did a pretty good job describing what the product looks like. But for those people that may want to see a picture of it or get more information on mobile IV systems, do you have a website they can go to?
Yes, we do. You can just, if you type in mobileivsystems.com, you will get us. My name is Brett Moore. I'm the CEO. I would be delighted to speak with anyone who would like to talk to us about the future development or deployment of the product.
Brett Moore, CEO, Mobile IV Systems, LLC in Brooklyn, New York. And thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
Brett Moore, that was a really interesting conversation. That IV technology providing just a little bit, the perfect amount of pressure to distribute IV fluids into a body. I wonder what that PS, did he say what the PSI is?
No, well, I don't know, but the canister provides a fixed amount of PSI, and there's a regulator in there that, that will be able to regulate it down automatically, be it IV fluids or full blood. So
a very interesting spattering and variety of interviews that you did while at the Future in Review conference a couple weeks ago up at Stein Erickson Lodge. We had an educational technology opportunity. We had this healthcare technology,
silicon
security.
Carbide 3D printing. And,
it was all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about your experience up there, because you moderated a panel, didn't you?
Oh, no, that was last year. That was the undiagnosed illnesses panel. But I just did a lot of interviews up there. And of course, we had our live program. And I also just attended a lot of the actual speeches, you know, parts of the conference and everything. It was good. It was very good.
It'd be great if we could get some more local folks to be able to attend that conference if they had any extra space at the end, because what's going on up there most of us don't even know about, yet it is some cutting-edge stuff from all around the world.
Yeah, we were able to bring some local people in at the end, and or not at the end, but as we got close to the conference date, and they very much enjoyed it, and I think we'll spread the word around.
Absolutely. Hey, let's take a quick break for underwriters. And first of all, I want to thank our underwriters of Cool Science Radio, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. Stay with us. We'll be right back with some cool science stories.
Earth moving, behooving.
The KPCW music crawls back.
Entrancing, romancing.
Saturday, November 18th.
We're grooving.
It's soothing.
Three bars, four bands.
It's local. Four yokels.
Oh yeah, baby, the KPCW music crawl.
Brace yourself, Bridget. KPCW.org for tickets.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, John Wells. That music crawl. Okay, I'm a little ashamed to admit, John, that I have been out of town the last 2 years. This will be the third annual KPCW music crawl.
Right.
I've missed it both times. Can you give me the highlights? I mean, have I missed the best party of the year?
Sure. So just the gist of it is, it's the most fun you can have with your clothes on. I'm not kidding you. It is so much fun. It's three venues, OP Rockwell, The Spur, Flanagan's. We've got five bands. Starts at 7:30. Everybody gets dressed up, and you can go PC funky. You can go PC eclectic. You know, we encourage people to dress, you know, interestingly, and then we adorn them with flashing lights and those sorts of things. And it's just nice to be able to cruise up and down Main Street. We actually take Main Street over, and we all have our picture taken in front of the Egyptian Theater. It's kind of an iconic, really cool photo of like 300-400 people. It's
oh,
cool.
Really? So you kind of wander in between these three venues for the entire evening, or are they scheduled? Do you start at OP Rockwell's? And
you know, we did that the first year. We started at OP's and then worked our way down the hill. But last year and this year, you start where you want to start, and you get your groups of people together. People go as couples. You know, a couple of people go or couples go. But increasingly what people are doing is getting a whole bunch of their friends together and going in mass and, you know, as a big group. And it's just fun. You just go where you want, when you want. It's $35. You get a couple of drink coupons, uh-huh. And, you know, you have full access.
And a fundraiser for this wonderful public radio station.
A fundraiser for KPCW that means so much to you and I.
Nice. Excellent. Okay, well, do you enjoy listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW? Then help us continue to bring you quality segments like you just heard, all these interviews on all these varied topics from the Future in Review Conference. Remember also, in addition and before the music crawl happening on November 18th, of course, we have got Live PC, Give PC. That's November 10th. Please donate to KPCW. It's online giving only, so go to our website, kpcw.org, click on the Live PC, Give PC button, and donate. You can do it now. It's easy. We're trying to raise $30,000 by midnight on November 10th. And of course, every donation helps. It's the day of giving. It's also a celebration in this town because people feel really good about giving to those nonprofits that help them out in their lives and that they care so much about. KPCW relies on your donations to stay on the air. And, you know, we do those two pledge drives a year to raise money, but that's only part of our budget. So these events like Live PC, Give PC, and the KPCW Music Crawl certainly help to push us over the edge towards staying afloat, staying live on air.
This is such a philanthropic town. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that all of us know so much about these nonprofits is because of what KPCW does to lift them up. All of the public service announcements at no cost, or all the different things we do for interviewing and shining a light on these nonprofits. So, you know, we have a big role there, and it's a role that we take seriously. So, you know, just imagine what KPCW does for you, and everybody feels differently. I mean, you know, if it's the traffic, or if it's the local news, or the eclectic Air Force DJs playing whatever they want, for the most part, or these little public affairs shows that we do. I mean, there's a lot of value to what we provide.
That's right. We've been doing Cool Science Radio for 4 years now.
I think it's a little over 4 years.
And, you know, we have learned so much, and we hear it from all of our listeners around town when we run into them at the post office or the grocery store, how much they also learn. If you're one of those people, keep us in mind on November 10th for Live PC, Give PC. I'm going to take a short break for our last underwriter, and we'll be back with NPR News when we return.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com.